Salut les rebelles intelligents, j'ai profité de ma venue à Las Vegas pour rencontrer un blogueur qui m'a beaucoup inspiré et d'ailleurs que je cite plusieurs fois dans Tout le monde n'a pas eu la chance de rater ses études. Ce blogueur, c'est Steve Pavlina qui vit ici. Donc on s'est rencontrés dans un café et je trouvais que nos discussions étaient tellement intéressantes que je me suis dit il faudrait que je la partage avec vous. Donc j'ai fait l'interview vraiment à l'arrache avec le matériel du bord. Vous allez voir, c'est pas super bien cadré, mais honnêtement, focalisez-vous sur ce que Steve partage. Vous allez voir, c'est vraiment, vraiment super intéressant. Salut Steve, ça va ?
Bonjour.
Donc Steve est américain, il a appris un peu le français mais pas suffisamment pour faire une interview en français, donc on va faire le reste en anglais.
So Steve, I'm really happy to do this interview with you now because I mean your blog inspired me back in the days like in 2007 to start my online career as a blogger. And so you have, I will do like quickly your introductions for people that don't know you. You have like a very popular website about personal development called Steve Pavlina. So it's your name, stevepavlina.com. And it's like full of very deep articles about a lot of subjects. Like, you know, I don't know if you were the one who invented the 30 day challenge, for example. Or you're the one who like make it popular?
The 30-day trial? Yeah, as far as I know, I was the one who popularized it. But it was a technique I borrowed from software development because I used to be a computer game developer.
Yeah.
So that was very common to use 30-day trials with, you know, software. You download a demo, you get to use it for 30 days, and then you have to buy it or register it. So, you know, I thought that's a great way to get people to buy software. It's also a great way to install or test new habits.
Yeah, and it was genius to just think about, hey, why not do like a trial, like software trial, but to anything in life. And so you wrote about that, you wrote about like your experiment with a polyphasic sleep, very interesting. So like how to sleep 2 to 4 hours every day without being tired.
Every day. Yeah, that was a crazy.
Because you did the Uberman, but there is also the everyday,
every man,
which is like a little.
It's a little easier because you get a longer nap at night, yeah, like maybe three hours at night.
Yeah. And so the goal is like you sleep like 2 to 4 hours, so 2 hours in case of Uberman, and you like you're not tired at all. It's like
in the beginning you are. It's terrible sleep deprivation for the first week or two, and then if your body can adapt, and I don't think everyone can adapt to it. I think it has to do with something genetic, because a lot of people that try it, no matter how disciplined they are, they just can't seem to do it. Mm-hmm. Whereas other people are able to adapt to it a little bit more easily. Then you know, then it becomes a lot easier. But it's pretty strict because you have to take a 20-minute nap, at least the way I did it, a 20-minute nap every 4 hours, continuously around.
And you
the clock.
You cannot be late.
You can a little bit. I could slide it to maybe 5 hours or 6 hours, but you can't skip a nap. That's really bad because you'll be paying for it for the next 24 hours. You'll just be very sleep deprived and really tired. But I did that for 5.5 months, and looking back, I almost can't believe I did it that long. And the main reason I stopped, though, is that it makes a mess of your social life. Because you have to live your life in 3 hour and 40 minute chunks. So, you know, I couldn't travel much during that time. I wasn't really into traveling back then a lot, but it's really hard
to
break
everything. You're so out of sync with everyone else.
You're out of sync with all of reality, but I'm glad I did it for a while because it was really fascinating. It's it gives you a whole different perspective on time because we're used to living our life one day at a time in these discrete, finite chunks. And when you're awake seemingly continuously, because these 20-minute naps are just small little breaks out of your day. It's not like you're really going for a big rest and resetting a new day. It's like it's one day all the way continuously. So from October when I started to April when I finished, it was like one day all the way through, it seemed like. It's like the sun comes up, the sun goes down, the sun comes up, the sun goes down. You're the constant now. It's not like the world is turning without you. You're there to see everything happening. And you see people go to bed, and then people get up in the morning, and you know, the city shuts down, and the city wakes up again. So this city doesn't shut down that much, though, because we're in Las Vegas.
Yeah, Las Vegas, no. Yeah. But yeah, it's like watching like a movie of everyone, like in acceleration.
Yeah, and it's a little surreal.
It gives you like a different perspective on time.
Uh-huh. But it makes you feel much more disconnected from everyone because you know, for one, you're spending a lot of time alone each night, unless you make nighttime friends and daytime friends or something like that. But it can get almost just too much. It's overwhelming or exhausting, just all the input you're taking in every 24 hours.
Yeah, but so you couldn't like create a community of people who were like you It's too rare.
You could. In fact, the people I know who've succeeded with this the longest, yeah. they yeah. created a community. Like 5 or 8 people got together and they did this as a group, and that gives them a lot more stability because now they can hang out with each other while they're doing this. Mm. I was doing it by myself, which I think was a lot harder, and it gets a bit lonelier at night because all your friends are asleep.
But, yeah. You know. So it acts for 5 months and a half.
Five and a half.
For sleeping 2 hours a day, man. Wow. So that's the kind of stuff you write about on your blog. Like so many articles. How many articles do you have? Like more than 1,000?
I think about 1,300.
So, yeah. Really? Yeah. Okay. So, and we are not talking about like short articles. I mean, go to the site and see it. So I'm curious about these 30 days challenges you did. What is the most life-changing 30-day challenge you did in your life?
That's an easy one. Okay. It was actually the very first one I did.
Yeah.
Which I did, this was long before I started blogging, before I did anything in business. When I was back at university, between 2 semesters in college, I got the idea that I wanted to try going vegetarian for 30 days. Mm. And I had a friend who was Indian, and he would always eat vegetarian. You know, so we'd go out for pizza, and he would eat cheese pizza, and I would have pepperoni pizza. And I always thought it was interesting, and he seemed very sharp mentally. And I thought he was like one of my smartest friends. And I thought, interesting, I wonder if there's a connection there. So I decided at some point in my life, I just wanted to try being vegetarian. I had no interest in going vegetarian, but I just wanted to try it. And I thought, what if I just try it for a month, like during the summer when I'm on vacation? So I did that, and it was just, it was really cool because it was actually really easy to do. And I noticed, like, I never went back on day 31 because I still had vegetarian food in the house. And so I kept eating that way for a while, and I know 6 months had passed, and I was still eating vegetarian. And I thought, well, I guess I'm a vegetarian. And I felt sharper mentally, just a little bit. It wasn't a huge increase. But that got me started, and it inspired me to, 3.5 years later to go vegan. And now I did that with a 30-day trial as well. And I liked it a lot. I just felt much more energy. I was doing martial arts at the time, and it really increased my sparring endurance.
This time it was not a little increase. You really...
This time it was a much bigger increase.
Okay.
And then I've used that to spawn all kinds of other 30-day trials. I've gone raw for 30 days, 100% eating raw foods for 30 days at a time, or eating raw for 6 months at a time. You don't have to do just 30 days. And now I've been vegan for 20 years, and that has made like a huge difference. People ask me, how do you write so much? And it's because of like... eating lighter foods so you have more energy for your mind.
And focus.
So you're not spending all your energy on digestion breaking down heavy foods. So then it's great for focus, it's great for mental endurance, being able to write for 4 or 5 hours at a time without taking a break, concentrating on just one article idea, all the way through. That was, if I had just one change to make, it would be going vegetarian and vegan. Like, if I could throw out everything else I did in my life, even entrepreneurship, I would throw that out.
Really?
I would just keep that one thing, because that gave me more benefits than anything else. Just eating, it's really simple to do in a way. I mean, just eating lighter on the food chain. And it gave me everything else I wanted in life, really. It came from that, so.
Wow. So I hope it's inspired you to do, like, tests, because, yeah, you really, like...
I'm really into testing. I'm not here to, like, preach any particular change to anybody. But I am really into testing, so try it for yourself.
How many tests do you do during a year? Do you do 12 or like one a month?
Oh, a year? It depends. I also do some really strange experiments. So sometimes I'm not doing any trials at all. Other times I'll do longer trials. Like this year, one of my goals is to go all of the whole year without any caffeine. So no coffee, no black tea, no green tea, no white tea. And also
no tea,
no chocolate, no stimulants whatsoever. Mm. The whole year.
Wow.
So I guess if I'm saying that on camera now, I'm committed to it.
Yeah, because it's the beginning of the year. So
yep.
Yeah, wow. So how do you, when you have challenges like that, how do you fight against the struggle? The urge to eat chocolate or to drink coffee or...
After you've gone a while on it, it's not that difficult. Okay. So last year I would have coffee occasionally. Sometimes a lot, especially when I would go to Europe because they have such good espresso there.
Yeah.
When I went to Italy, I was having espresso every day because it's really good. Or when I would go to France, I'd have it there. I'd get hooked on it and I'd get addicted to it. And I noticed it would make my thoughts more scrambled. I wouldn't be as clear, as focused. So then I'd make a bigger commitment. Like I'd go, okay, I'm doing a month with no caffeine at all. And then I'd, after like a week or two, once I got past the caffeine hangover, I'd be done with it. And I wouldn't even want it anymore. I wouldn't crave it anymore. And then I'd notice how much more relaxed my mind was. It was, you know, calm instead of like crazy all over the place, you know, with coming up with constant ideas and just cluttering my mind with all this fluff. And without caffeine at all, it's like, it's nice and calm. I can just focus more easily on one thought at a time.
So Tim Ferriss just released a new book, Tools of Titans. And
I've heard of it. I haven't read it.
Yeah, I began to read it, and it's like a lot of interviews from his podcast, you know. And he also gives like a few very interesting questions to ask people. So I borrow a few of the questions he shared in his book for you. Okay. So the first one is, when you think of the word successful, who is the first person who comes to your mind and why?
Leonardo da Vinci is one that comes to mind.
Okay, why?
Because he was successful in so many different fields, because he mastered so many different arts. I mean, he was an artist, he was designing military technology, he was, you know, learning about early aviation.
very early.
Yeah, mathematics, you know, various sciences he was getting into. So I like that model, because, you know, a lot of people in the world tell you have to niche down and go to just, you know, one narrow focus, and you have to be an expert of that. But I've actually found that very disheartening, because when I was going to start my blog in 2004, I realized if I pick any one narrow focus, like time management, I'm going to be bored with that in a year or two, or maybe 5 years if I can stretch it. And then it'll just be heartless work to maintain that empire or whatever I built around it. So I just thought, I don't want to do that. I have so many different interests. I really want to explore life, and I don't want to get to the end of life and look back and think about all the things I missed out on because my focus was too narrow. So I like doing deep dives temporarily. And then I like to resurface, look at the big picture of life, and maybe pick a whole new direction.
And you have a new skills.
Yeah. So I don't want to just be like just one guy who does only one thing, you know, really well. I want to do a lot of things, and do them at a significant amount of depth. So I call that the mile wide, mile deep strategy. And, you know, people say you have to go a mile wide, or okay, so if this is for French, a kilometer wide and a centimeter deep.
All
the reverse. Sure. Yeah. And so, or you have to go, you know, the opposite of that. And
so to do that, you have like, yeah, period of time when you focus deeply on a subject. And then when you're done, you go on something else. Like when we met in Los Angeles a few months ago, you told me you were really into typography for a time, like 2 months maybe. Yeah. And you wrote a lot of articles about that in your blog. But now you don't read anymore about this and...
That deep dive was just a couple of days. Yeah, about 2 days to learn typography.
Really?
Yeah. Because there's a lot of good websites where you'll learn the basics really quickly.
And I have to say, you on your blog, you have pretty good fonts. And we exchanged a few emails, and I asked you what is the font you're using, because I don't know, it's so smooth, you know, so smooth. It's like, it's pleasurable to read your emails, because it's different than the font of everyone else. I'm exchanging email with, you know.
Oh, okay.
So, yeah, it's
well, the one I use on my website is a font called Charter. The one I use in email is just one of the built-in fonts that Gmail lets you use. I picked Garamond for that because it only gives you a handful of choices, and so I picked the one that was closest to the one on my website.
Okay.
If I could use Charter in an email easily, it would work. I'd have to copy something from my blog, paste it into an email, and then edit the text, and it would continue using Charter, I think, for that. But otherwise, it's... You know, it's close enough.
But so Leonardo da Vinci was like a genius in a lot of fields, and he had an impact in a lot of fields. Also in some fields, his impact didn't last, like early aviation. It was not really, you know. Don't you think that's also...
Modeling a bird didn't quite work for airplanes.
Yeah. Don't you think it can also like be like dispersion to do what he did? And do you think it's possible to have an impact in a lot of fields today, because it's like 5 centuries later on, we have way more knowledge in every field than before?
I think, you know, for me, I originally made the decision just for lifestyle reasons, but I found it beneficial. And one of the things I noticed is that people get a very narrow focus in a certain field, and they only use, you know, let's say you're running a business in a certain field, you'll find that everybody in that field uses the same marketing techniques. Like lawyers, they all tend to market themselves the same way. And then you go to a different field, like, you know, online marketing, you know, online marketers marketing themselves. They do things very differently than lawyers do.
Yeah.
And then you go to a totally different field, like, you know, restaurateurs, and you'll find that they market their businesses totally differently. And so if you just look at it from a marketing perspective, if you hop around different fields and do deep dives into different areas, you're going to learn so many different techniques for marketing your own business. So and that's very true. Like, you know, you'll also learn different techniques that can help you grow faster by adapting ideas. Like, since I used to be a computer programmer and worked as a game developer, I use ideas from game development to enhance my current business or my lifestyle. Like the 30-day trial idea I got from software development. Taking an algorithmic approach, you know, like a step-by-step, you know, what's the process approach to personal development or to setting my goals. I use a very methodical approach to goal achievement a lot of the time that I got from writing computer programs. You know, there's so many things you can transplant from one field to another that will make you look like a genius because nobody else is doing that.
Right.
And because I explore so many different fields, I notice things in the blogosphere, you know, in blogging that everybody says, okay, here's the rules, you have to do this. And I tend to find better results by breaking the rules. As soon as I see somebody saying, here's what you need to do, here's what you need to focus on, I realize their focus is being too narrow and they're missing a lot of the big picture that they would get if they explored different fields. For instance, there's a huge emphasis on search engine optimization, which is something I completely ignore to a large extent. And I've been ignoring that all along, and yet my website does really well in search engines.
Very well, yeah.
And you know, people are constantly telling me they're searching on something and they find my website. I've had old friends look me up because they found my website from, you know, various searches. And the thing there is, though, is that I see a bigger picture because I've explored other fields, and so I know that this overemphasis on search engine optimization is a dead end. Because it's all tactic-based, and it's all technique-based, and it's not going to last, because Google's going to get smarter and smarter and smarter, and I thought, this is just, you know, this is not the way to go. So I focused on, instead of SEO, I call it HBO, human visitor optimization. I decided I'm going to write my articles for human beings, not for computers, and I thought about, what's the long term here? And I thought, what I want to do is I really want to connect with people on a human level, on an emotional level, not come across as fake or phony or stuff all kinds of artificial keywords in my articles just to get a ranking that's only going to last for a certain amount of time. Instead, like, really impact people. And so I focused, you know, instead of trying to trick technology into doing my bidding for me, it's like really help people, you know, really focus on deepening my sense of caring, deepening my sense of compassion when I write. Really getting into the mindset of the people I'm writing for and what their problems are, and going deep on the human side versus going shallow, you know, semi-deep on the technology side in a way that's going to be very temporary. And the cool thing is, like, people are still, you know, somebody in Launch Club actually just posted one of my articles in the group that they found by doing an organic search on Google, and there was an article I wrote in 2006.
Oh.
You know, and then people are discussing the article. So I'm like, okay, an article I wrote 10 years ago, people are still finding it in search engines.
Yeah.
And, you know, what rises you up in a search engine? It's a search engine is just another type of referral. When enough people start referring, you know, through social media, through linking to your articles from their blog, that causes you to get a higher page rank and rise up in Google. So I focus on, you know, getting the humans to refer, not the machines. And if the humans refer, the machines pick up on that, and then they refer, if that makes sense.
Yeah,
but I think if you try to bypass the human element and go straight to the machine element, you're missing something really important there.
Yeah.
And then when people get to your website, they're like, oh, this is just a fluff piece, and they click off because they don't feel engaged.
Yeah, so to summary what you say is, like, everyone should, like, have a scientific approach to their life by doing experiments. And you do this, you fuel this by your curiosity. You want to explore different areas and just learn the basic stuff that everybody is using in a field but not in another. And just by bringing a common stuff in a field in another field that nobody knows about it, it's like you're genius.
Exactly.
You look like a genius, but you're just using, like, basic stuff that nobody heard in this particular field. And so when you mix curiosity with a good approach, which is the experiment, so you're really open-minded and you're just looking at the results you get, you can, like, get more skills and more creativity than most people without too much work. So it can be very fun.
What people are missing is they look at the opportunity cost of like switching fields, but I'm not suggesting you have to switch fields. I'm suggesting you explore deeply in a lot of different fields, and you'll find that all those things enhance each other, that they actually make you a better expert in each thing that you explored.
Because you see the interrelations.
But it's not about doing a shallow exploration of each thing. It's actually about going to significant depth in each area. So you're not just going to dabble endlessly and just like do things for a couple days here, a couple days there. It's like go really deep into more than one thing.
So for example, you just said like you studied for a few days typography. Do you think it was a deep dive or not?
That was a very temporary, short deep dive. Okay. But it was a very functional one. I needed to look at better fonts for my website. So that included looking at 600 different fonts before I picked which one
600.
I wanted.
600?
Yeah.
All right.
I went through like every Google font, and then I ended up picking something that wasn't even in the Google fonts. And looking at even more to try to find something that I felt looked good. And things I learned about typography, I could see how they impacted or related to other fields. And I could use knowledge in one field to enhance my knowledge in another field. Yeah. See, when we learn, if you study the brain, and I've studied a lot of neuroscience, the way the brain works is it's always building connections with what we already have. And so when you learn new knowledge, it has to find something to connect it to. So if you create a broad base of things that your brain can connect new knowledge to, then it has an easier time classifying things. When you study something new like topography, I was like, how do I hang this? What is this? This seems like this whole field hanging out there by itself. But I very quickly was able to connect it with something else that I already understood. Like typography is actually a form of self-expression. And I understand self-expression really well because I do that as a speaker and as a writer. And so the way I picked the fonts is I thought, what is the message I'm trying to deliver? And I realized typography it communicates something. If you do use a really flowery font, that might be appropriate for a wedding invitation, but it may not be appropriate for, reading technical material.
Sure.
So whatever I picked, I thought this is communication. So I wanted to pick a font that aligns with the message I want to put out. I want something that's accessible, fairly easy to read, but when you look at it closely, there's some depth to it. And so you probably won't notice this, but if you look at some of the fonts on my website, you'll notice they have slight embellishments around like the edges, like the certain letters will have like these little curved parts or these little triangle shaped parts. And it's not something you'll notice at first glance, but you only notice it when you look deeper. And so there's actually a message behind the typography I chose, and that everything was chosen, every font on every element of the site was chosen very deliberately. And it's to enhance the message. And it's just like, any kind of communication. But I didn't realize it was a form of communication. I thought it's just something, you pick it to look nice, right?
Yeah.
And so when I understood it, then I could connect my study of typography to things I already knew, like self-expression. And then I go, instantly, I get it. Another example was I explored fashion many years ago. It's not something I got terribly into, but in 2009, I did a deep dive into fashion. I had a friend that was interested in it. And we went on the late Las Vegas Strip. And we went shopping, and he was showing me all these different things. And I bought like a $200 shirt, and was trying this on. And I was like, okay, I see I understand a little bit more about this. And typography is much like fashion. So boom, two things, very different fields. But now you can connect the dots.
Yeah.
And now I could use all my knowledge that I understood from doing a deep dive into fashion. I could instantly transfer it over to typography. It is self-expression. Mm. And what I understood about picking clothes that I liked and that would express myself, I like that. I like clothing that it looks plain and simple when you look at it from far away. But when you get close, you realize there's a pattern to it. Like this might look like a plain solid color shirt, but it actually has texture to it. It's got lines going across it that are slightly different colors.
All right.
There's like something a little bit different about it. And that's the kind of thing I like to express because that's how I feel. I like being accessible, but when you get to know me, you realize there's a lot of depth. And that's how I like to get to know people. It's like, I like to have a very friendly connection, but go deep quickly.
Yeah.
And so it's all communication. But you see how everything, like from all these different fields that you wouldn't even think you could connect, it does connect?
Yeah.
I had a lot of other questions from Tim, but since we're running out of time, there is a topic I really want to talk about. It's open relationship.
Okay.
because you shared a lot about this like a few years ago. You don't do it too much anymore. So and I think you have like a lot of things to say about this. First, are you still in open relationship today?
Yep, for 7 years.
7 years.
Yep. In fact, our 7 year anniversary is in 2 days.
Wow. Yeah. Congrats.
7 years since we first got together.
Wow. So just
and we're not married though.
So how would you define an open relationship?
You know, everyone defines it differently. Yeah. We tend to be monogamous when we're together, but if we're in other cities or we travel a lot, mm-hmm. Then it's like, it's okay if you want to connect or play with somebody else. Uh-huh. Or we'll have threesomes together. We've done that many times. So we even did, we even went to an orgy recently.
Really?
Yeah. First time. I'm not really an orgy kind of guy, but it was kind of fun to just have that experience for the first time and see what it was like. And,
yeah, here in Las Vegas?
Yeah, here in Las Vegas. Right. I don't think either of us were all that into it, but it was like, okay.
Yeah. Let's explore.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. So, so it means when you're together, you do threesomes, and sometimes you have adventures when you go abroad and you're not together. Do you share this or do you don't talk too much?
Yeah. No, we share. Share? But there's an unusual element to our relationship and that we're not just in an open relationship, we're also in a long-distance relationship. So I'm American, and she, Rochelle, is Canadian.
Yeah, and she lives in?
And she'll stay here with me about 6 months out of the year, which is about the legal limit.
Yeah.
And so we don't break the law or anything like that. But since we're not married, you know, we can't be in each other's countries for too long. So I can sometimes go visit her in Canada, or more often, we'll go travel together somewhere. Like last year, we went to spend a few weeks in Mexico, we went to Costa Rica, we went to London, went to Rome, and we also spent some time in Canada together. Wow. So we'll travel to usually a few countries each year. We've been to France a couple of times, just Paris, and Versailles.
Okay, Versailles, yeah, which is very close. So you see each other like 6 months a year or more with all the travels? And
Usually more, usually about 7-8 months a year, I'd have to say.
Okay, so still, that's like a few months.
But we'll spend 4 or 5 months apart each year. Sometimes for, you know, pretty long stretches. It could just be for a few weeks apart, but it might be for 2 or 3 months apart. So I think the longest we've done is maybe just over 3 months.
So do you share spontaneously the adventures you have with other people, or is like sometimes you ask, so what, who are you into right now?
Yeah, it's kind of like just spontaneously. I tend to be pretty opportunistic and pretty lazy, so I don't tend to just go out of my way to try to create a new connection, but sometimes things just happen. You know, like it often happens when I'm traveling by myself. Then, you know, I might have a nice playful connection with somebody. Now that could, it's usually just really short term. So that could be just like for a few days up to, you know, at the most was maybe like 3 weeks or so.
3 weeks, yeah. Yeah. Of course, when you're traveling, it's like, okay.
But this is another area where I neither of us are the jealous types. This is another area where I feel like doing this other exploration, it actually enhances your primary relationship because it gives you more of a sense of variety. And when, you know, when we're out of town or when I've connected with somebody else and then I go back to Rochelle, it reminds me what I appreciate about her. And I feel much more gratitude. It's like our relationship doesn't get stale in that sense.
And so you were not jealous at all in the first place. So you don't have to deal with it because it's a big problem for a lot of people.
No, in fact, I'm like trying to push her to connect more with other guys. I'm like, you know, you haven't connected, you know, yeah. You're not doing enough in that area. It's like, go out and connect more with other guys.
And why do you feel that she needs more?
I think it's good for us. I think it's good for the variety, you know. And anything she learns from connecting with another guy, it's like now she can bring that to our relationship and enhance it.
Interesting.
So because that's how I feel when I connect with somebody else. It's like it reminds me of what I really appreciate about Rochelle. And anything I really liked about that short-term connection, then I can bring that into our relationship. You know, like what went so well? Why did it go well? Like you learn something from every person.
So a lot of people will ask, what if you want child with this type of relationship?
What if you
want children?
Then that's going to be more complicated.
Yeah, because you already have 2 children from a previous marriage. Exactly. Yeah, so you don't want them more.
I don't want any more kids right now.
Yeah, yep. Something to consider.
Yep. Yeah. So, I mean, you know, it's a lifestyle choice. It's not something I think is right for everyone.
So you didn't feel challenging at all, this kind of relationship?
Challenging? Yeah. No, it feels totally normal, totally natural to me. Getting into it can be challenging, you know, because there's a lot of limiting beliefs to unlock. But once you're in it, you know, after you've been in it for 7 years, it's just normal. It's like breathing. You know, it's you. Then you look at other people's relationship and you see, well, okay, well, they've got their relationships in a box. You know, it's what one person calls fenced relationships.
Yeah, fenced. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So the book Sex 3.0 talks about that.
Sex 3.0?
Yeah, Sex 3.0.
Okay.
Talks about it, instead of using open and closed relationships, it calls them fenced and unfenced. So, like, you have a fence around it. And with unfenced, it means there's no fence. So you can walk out anywhere and connect with anybody else.
Yeah. I think it's such an interesting topic because we are, first, it's very interesting to experiment by yourself. And it's also something that is so shaped by society. Society is defining how you should behave in your relationship with, you know, people you love. And when you realize society tells you something, but like everything it tells you, you can challenge it and try something else. Because when you are between adults and you agree on something, you're just limited by your imagination and the comfort zone of other people. Yep. So it begins to be a whole new playground. And you can experiment a lot with that.
You also find out more about what you like while you're still in a relationship. So you can explore your current relationship and also just learn more things you like more patterns. You don't have to like put your personal growth in your relationship area on hold or put it in a box and limit yourself. You get to keep exploring. Like there's some things that surprised me. Like I'm actually really into women that have some kind of French in their background.
Yeah.
As funny as that sounds, yeah. Rochelle is French Canadian.
Yeah.
But many of the women I've had the best connections with, they've been, you know, like partly French, like French something.
I think the universe is sending you the sign that you should learn French.
Maybe.
Steve, right? Maybe the next interview will be in French. Let's hope for that. You want to do a deep dive in French?
I thought about it. I did take 3 years of French in high school.
Yeah.
But I had a teacher who was Basque. And so he taught us.
Basque?
For the first 2 years.
Okay.
And so apparently we learned this weird accent when we were trying to learn French.
Oh, okay.
And then the third year we had a woman who had actually been to France for a while, lived there for a while, and she was having to correct all our accents.
All right.
But when I don't speak it, I forget it. I can actually read French fairly decently.
Wow.
But speaking it and pronouncing it, it's really difficult.
All right.
Understanding the spoken word, I can understand a little bit of it. I'll pick up, you know, a few words here and there. Like quelque chose, I know that word.
Quelque chose. Great. So to finish this interview, I think a lot of people would be interested in exploring open relationship, but at the beginning, it's hard for them to meet other people who are open to this because it's still like, it's not very mainstream, right? Did you find hard to connect with women who were open to this?
Not at all.
No. How come?
Yeah.
It's because you live in Las Vegas and
you know,
it's like...
I think... No, but I've actually had hardly any connections with people locally. It's almost always when I'm traveling.
Interesting.
Yeah, it's almost always when I'm traveling or it's somebody else traveling here. But I'm not really into the local scene here in terms of like open relationships.
It will bring the last question, but first, so how come you connected so easily with...
I feel like a lot of it had to do with just aligning my beliefs and getting past the fear and the shame and, you know, the like how will other people judge me. So I worked on that first, and when I did that, it just unlocked everything. And I realized people think that the block is that it's something external, that there's nobody out there that will be into this, but really the block is, I think, a lot more internal than we realize, that we're blocking ourselves because we're not comfortable with it on some level. So I gradually did things to make myself comfortable with it. I blogged about it, was one.
Yeah.
So I put myself out there, and I, you know, when I had a Twitter account, I don't have a Twitter account anymore. There is somebody impersonating me on Twitter now, but I don't have an account. So I haven't had an account since 2014. But when I did, I had around 30,000 plus Twitter followers. And I practiced, you know, sharing things with them. Like I wrote, I heart threesomes. And I realized what happened is when I got to the point where I was no longer ashamed of it and I was no longer worried about what people thought, I could do anything.
And people would come to you saying, oh, great.
Like when I wrote, I heart threesome, so I love threesomes, and put that on Facebook to 30,000 people, I didn't get a single negative piece of feedback. Yeah, I got people writing back like, oh, me too, or good for you, or you know, things like that. And I realized, like, when you have no resistance to something, the world stops resisting bringing it to you. But when you resist it, people pick up on that. Like when I, and now I see it from the opposite perspective, because when I'm into an open relationship, and I see somebody who might want to connect in that area, but they're not really congruent with it yet, I can feel the resistance in them. I can see it, and I wouldn't want to introduce them to that world. And I realized that's what people were doing with me. And as soon as I opened myself up and became comfortable with it, people I already knew told me, oh yeah, you know, I've been in an open relationship for years. You know, like famous authors, speakers that I knew, they would come and tell me by private email. I won't say who it is. but these, I said, you were, you know, you're that way? And they said, yeah. And I said, why didn't you tell me? I said, because I didn't think you'd be cool about it. And I thought, oh, okay.
Interesting.
Yeah. So as soon as I put myself out there as a person who's comfortable with it and is curious about it, that's especially important. It's like, be a good student. Say, I want to learn this. Say, I like this idea. I'm open to it. I really want to learn. And then it was just like the floodgates poured in. So many people from that community just emailed me and they're saying, read this book. Read this book. Here's how you can find people. Here's how you can find partners. They just told me.
Awesome.
And it was actually really easy. And so much of it is just getting the comfort and putting yourself out there. And then you can just make invitations and things will show up. Like when Rochelle and I decided we want to have our first threesome, this was back in 2010. We didn't know how to do this, so we just, I think I posted on my Facebook page that we were interested in having our first threesome.
Wow.
And somebody from my Facebook followers said, oh, I'm coming to Vegas in a few weeks, I'll have a threesome with you guys. So somebody I never even met, you know, so she, yeah, so she comes over to my house and we have a threesome together. And I was like, oh, wow, that was awesome.
It
was like,
you just have to ask.
Yeah, it was like, that's all it took. And once that happened, it's then like, you know, then it would almost just happen spontaneously sometimes. Or it'd just be like, you could kind of tell, like, you'd pick up this radar, like, you think, I bet you she would love to have a threesome with us. And then you would ask her, and she's like, yeah, okay, why not? You know, you're realizing it's that easy. Like, you could just ask, and somebody might say yes. I'm trying to remember if we even asked anybody that ever said no. Or it's like, you just get maybe. I don't recall, but you just get kind of fine-tuned to it, and you kind of know when the yes is going to happen. It's like a calibration process. And it's like you get that sense, but you don't even notice that kind of thing beforehand because you're repelling people and not even realizing you're doing that.
Wow, awesome. So to finish on a lighter touch, I was always intrigued to see someone, because you're someone with really high integrity and high transparency, as we can see. So why are you living in the city that is, I mean, Las Vegas. The surname of Las Vegas is Sin City. So I don't know. For me, it was always a mismatch somewhere.
I get asked that a lot.
Yeah.
Some people say, like, Steve, I know you're kind of a spiritual guy too. Why would you want to live in a city like this? You know, it seems like the total opposite of your message.
Right.
And I say, no, it's completely aligned with my message. I said, Las Vegas is all about freedom and possibility. I mean, here we've built this oasis in the desert. To me, I find that inspiring. You know, we have our own Eiffel Tower here.
Yeah, true.
It's about, you know, it's like half scale, but it's, yeah, you know, I've been to the top of both, the one in Paris and the one here in Las Vegas.
Oh.
And it's, you know, what I love about Las Vegas most is that it's a very non-judgmental place to live. Mm. And so I can do all these crazy lifestyle experiments. I can constantly reinvent myself and not feel a lot of social pressure to be a certain way. This is a city where a lot of people come to reinvent themselves. You know, a lot of people come here and start new lives. And I found that really fascinating. I really got caught up in the energy of that place. I'm not into the drinking or the gambling or the staying up all night, you know, going to the casinos. That's not my scene. But I love the sense of freedom and possibility that this city has.
Awesome.
And, you know, that we built this oasis in the desert. It tells me, like, hey, if we can do this, you know, we built these huge structures. We have a pyramid. We've got our own Statue of Liberty. We've got
a roller coaster in the casino.
We've got Venetian canals.
Yeah.
You know, it's like everything.
Pyramids.
We have ancient Rome with Caesar's Palace.
Yeah.
So it's like, it's all here. We brought it all to the, you know, to what was once a barren wasteland. And I thought if we can do that, that's wonderful. And so to me, Las Vegas is one of the most spiritual cities on earth. Because it gives you total freedom to explore who you are as a human being without shoving you too much in any one direction. You know, and all the temptation is there. Any direction you want to go, you want to drink, gamble, stay up late at night, sleep with prostitutes, you know, it's like people aren't going to judge you for that. So you want to explore anything, it's fine. And that I love. So I've lived here for actually this month is 13 years.
Searching.
Yeah.
And you love it.
Yeah.
Because now you could live anywhere.
I could. I still like the city.
Yeah. Interesting. Okay, wow. So thank you very much for this very deep interview. So if you want to connect with Steve, you can go on his website, stevepalavina.com. There is also, if you are not in English, the French translation that I do, Devenez meilleur. Yeah, I don't know. Do you have a specific message you want to share with the French world, maybe?
How do you say live consciously in French?
Vivez consciemment.
Vivez consciemment.
Consciemment, yeah. Consciemment. All right, thank you, Steve.
Hey! Merci d'avoir écouté ce MP3 qui est tiré d'une vidéo publiée sur la chaîne YouTube. Donc, comme d'habitude, j'ai besoin de votre feedback. Si vous aimez écouter ces podcasts sur iTunes, eh bien, allez tout simplement sur iTunes pour noter cette émission. Voilà, donnez-lui une note si vous l'appréciez. Et puis, comme d'habitude, vous pouvez voir les vidéos originales desquelles sont extraits les podcasts en allant sur olivier-roland.tv. Hein, olivier-roland, R-O-L-A-N-D. TV. Merci d'avoir écouté ce podcast. À demain pour de nouvelles aventures dans le prochain.